You're listening to Melissa and Lori Love Literacy. When you can spell a word, you can read a word. But is the opposite true, too? Spoiler alert, it's not. We know that everyone is talking about the science of reading. But have you been wondering what the role of spelling is? We have, too. And today we'll be talking to Pam Kastner about the important role of teaching spelling to help your students read and write.
Sometimes a podcast is enough, and sometimes you might want something more.
So we wrote a book answering your questions called The Literacy 50, a Q&A handbook for teachers, real-world answers to questions about reading that keep you up at night.
It's a handbook that includes downloadable resources for planning and instruction. You'll love the practical tips we supply to bridge the research-to-practice gap.
Pre-order your copy now on Amazon.
Hi, teacher friends. I'm Lori.
And I'm Melissa.
We are two educators who want the best for all kids, and we know you do too.
We worked together in Baltimore when the district adopted a new literacy curriculum.
We realized there was so much more to learn about how to teach reading and writing.
Lori and I can't wait to keep learning with you today.
Hi, everyone. We can't wait for today's conversation because we are discussing the connection between spelling and reading.
And we're here today with Pam Kastner. Pam is an educational consultant at Patton and serves as the state lead for literacy in my home state of Pennsylvania. She's also a professor at Mount St. Joseph University in the Reading Science Program. And we are so excited you're here with us today. Welcome, Pam.
Oh, it's such an honor to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me, Melissa and Lori.
Lori's been talking about your session at Plain Talk since we got back, so.
I have to tell you, I put all the notes on a notepad in my phone, and I can't delete it. It's just, I just keep adding to it, so thank you for that.
Oh, I
know we met at Plain Talk, you know, back in January, and my biggest takeaway from that really amazing presentation you did is that when we are teaching spelling, we are teaching reading. So I thought it might be helpful for us to kick off today's conversation with you sharing how spelling connects to reading.
Well, they are reciprocal processes. There's no doubt about that. But one way I start out my presentation, which you took part in, is I have a series of words, about four of them, that I put up on a screen. And I say, okay, we're going to read these words and it's going to be choral. And I'm going to see how fluent you are at reading these words. And in every single case, all four of those words, they read them accurately and automatically. They are in their sight word vocabulary. And then I say, okay, let's take out a pencil and paper or take out your phone and write in a text yourself. We're going to spell those words. So in every single case, and I've done this many times, I've only once ever gotten a 4 out of 4 where the words were in the participant's sight word vocabulary, but also they were able to spell them, which meant they had complete and accurate recall and memory for that word. So it really shows that we're making that statement about spelling and reading are reciprocal processes. They really are. However, spelling is a much higher linguistic skill. And if you can spell a word, you can read a word, but it kind of shows them right from the beginning. If you can read a word, it doesn't mean you can spell it. So you're benefiting reading when you're teaching spelling. It's like one of those rare cases when you can be so efficient with your instruction and you're getting like double bang for your buck. And that doesn't happen very often. But unfortunately, in the world of linguistics, our language systems, I think that spelling is not, it's like maybe the stepchild of all the language systems. It doesn't get the attention that it should. So just like in the presentation, I've been telling everybody, no matter whether I'm training on spelling or anything else, my name is Pam Spelling Kastner, just to bring attention to how important it is and what benefits it can realize for teachers and for kids. So do you want to do that? Do you want me to have the audience do that?
I was just going to ask you if you wanted to give some examples.
Yeah. Okay. So pretend that I've just placed the word accommodate for you up on the screen. You've read it accurately and automatically. And now I'm going to ask you to just take out a pencil and paper and spell it.
I'm writing it down, but I think I'm cheating.
Okay. The next word I put up is fuchsia, which is a beautiful color. And always when I'm doing this, I say the word, you say the word, and I use it in a sentence, right? So fuchsia is a beautiful color. And my sentence for accommodate is I have 6 grandchildren. When they come to my house, I always accommodate my 6 grandchildren. Next word is narcissistic. To be narcissistic is not an enviable trait. What's my word?
Narcissistic.
Good job. Last word, onomatopoeia. What word?
Oh.
That's a tricky one.
But in every case, everyone reads it accurately. Onomatopoeia is a literary device. What word?
Onomatopoeia.
Onomatopoeia. So
it's focused on trying to spell it.
Back in your own homes or wherever you are, hopefully if you're driving, you didn't do this, you pulled over. But what you'll likely find is that you are able to read these words, but if you cover them and then attempt to spell them, you likely will have some errors because you do not yet, and I always like to say yet, have a complete and accurate memory for that word stored. So it just shows us how important spelling is in calling attention to the internal structure of words. Oftentimes when kids are reading, we see them look at the beginning parts and maybe the end, and sometimes even throw in a synonym there. And so when we're spelling, we must pay attention to the entire sequence, the letter sequence, its pronunciation, and then bond it to meaning to map it. So it's just an incredible way to both benefit spelling, but also reading.
I'm curious with those words, just if I can read them, but I can't spell them. I feel like some people might ask, like, well, so what? If I can't spell that word, why does it matter if I can read it just fine?
Well, because people judge your intelligence for sure based on your spelling ability. We certainly know that even from some research around job applications when there are spelling errors. Even if, you know, it doesn't infer your intelligence, but people will make a judgment around spelling. So people who are good readers but poor spellers, they don't have fully specified memories for those words. They're able to kind of sample in because when you're reading the word, like right in front of you, everything is there that you need to decode it if you have the knowledge, right? So you map the sequence of letters to its pronunciation. If you're reading it in text, right, after you've decoded it, you can kind of check yourself with meaning. So you have a lot of information supplied for you when you're reading, but when you're spelling, you know, you're pretty much starting from scratch. I always think about it this way, because I taught kindergarten many years. You know, kids begin with speech, right? What comes out their mouth comes out their pencil, right? And then they map those letter sequences to the phonemes. They're mapping a phoneme to a grapheme. So they begin with speech and move to print. And it's a much more difficult skill. You're holding those sounds in memory. You have to remember what the grapheme form looks like for that particular spelling. Of that phoneme. And also, you know, although not talked about very much, you have to write it. There's graphomotor things going on as well, right? So it's a highly complex skill, writing is, and spelling is as well. It's a linguistic skill, but sometimes there's confusion. They think it's a visual memory process. So in particular, words that are high-frequency words, and I listen to Katie and Danielle again. I'm big fans of both of their research. We've had this misunderstanding of spelling that it's a visual memory process when it's a linguistic process. And the benefits by focusing on those linguistic processes through spelling is that it benefits not only the spelling, but also the reading.
Yeah, no, I feel like that really resonates. And the thing that I compare it to in my brain is the idea that the highest, you know, level for like how reading and writing are reciprocal, and the highest level for exporting and knowing what you're reading about is writing. And in between there is that oral discourse or some sort of oral
support, rehearsal.
Yes, oral rehearsal. Thank you. Yeah. So that, I mean, then that really does kind of bridge it and bring it around to a full circle. And so that's kind of making a lot of sense here with what you're saying about spelling and reading as well.
Yeah. Oh, good. And the handwriting. Throw a little handwriting in there too. So there you go.
So I think we're going to switch gears a little bit now to talk about instruction, because that's what our listeners want to hear about, is how do we teach spelling? So I just want to, thinking back to how I learned how to spell, was not good. Was, you know, those spelling lists we got on Monday, and then they seemed like kind of random, you know, 10 random words. I don't know where they came from. And then homework throughout the week, we wrote them 5 times each, sentences, whatever we did during the week. And then we had a test on Friday. And then I don't think we really saw those words anymore. That was kind of it, right? We saw we got the test and
that
we were done.
That happened for me. It was like words on Monday, practice them at home for the most part. And then Friday, take the test, and Saturday, forget them. Right?
Exactly. Which is clearly not the best way. So let's talk about better ways to do it. I just wanted to start with that first question of just which words to choose. And so can you talk a little bit about how teachers would choose words, and probably even bigger than that of, you know, what would a whole effective scope and sequence for teaching spelling look like?
Well, hopefully from the beginning, there would be, again, that reciprocal relationship between phonics. From decoding and encoding, the phonics patterns that we're teaching would then follow through with words with those phonics patterns that they would be asked for. As humans, we're pattern seekers, right? So we would want to teach them in patterns. It would go, we would teach it explicitly, not implicitly. We would teach the language system. So by explicitly, I mean directly. It would be systematic. It would be taught from least complex to most complex. We would be teaching, when we taught these patterns, the principles of spelling. So, for example, like position, those orthotactic constraints. So, there is no, as you guys know and your listeners know, there's no one universal phonics scope and sequence, right? However, when you look at those that align with the evidence, they follow those structures, least complex to most complex. And most frequent way we would spell this phoneme with graphemes to least. So we're very systematic in our instruction. We're very explicit with it. And we're marrying decoding and encoding. What I'm reading, I should be spelling. What I'm spelling, I should be reading, especially in the early grades, to help kids understand this principle, that alphabetic principle, that we represent speech sounds with graphemes. And when we're spelling, we're representing, you know, the opposite way around. So like the Hannah, Hodges, and Rudolph, that long ago seminal research that, you know, talks about spelling patterns that would influence our spelling. I think it's important to have that background knowledge so that teachers can be like critical consumers of the materials that they have and make adjustments where necessary based on that knowledge. But it would be very systematic, and it would, as Denise Ide, I don't know if you had her on. You did, I think. I haven't had a chance to listen to that yet. I have to. I think that's why she's called it the logic of English, right? We are trying to make it very clear there is a logic to our language, and not, in, you know, send the message that it's you know, disarrayed and we can't really figure out. It's, you know, we often hear the term like English is crazy. It really isn't. When we know our own language, we can look at any word and we can tell you, oh, that's why it's spelled that way. You know, we have a really robust, rich language, and we borrowed from many other languages. And oftentimes when we look at a spelling, that is one way we can say, oh, the reason it's spelled this way or pronounced that way is because, you know, the CH, maybe Denise talked about that, many people do, but Anglo-Saxon is going to be pronounced ch. And if it is a Greek origin, it's going to be k. And if it's French, you're going to hear sh. So the kids, the spelling is stable, but the pronunciation is influenced by its word origin. And I find that kids love that. They love being word detectives and, oh, this is why it's spelled that way. And then it makes, it's logical. So I think that for myself, I will say years ago, these were things that were not taught to me. So you can't teach what you don't know. So, you know, we need to know our own language so that we can teach it.
I'm thinking if I were a listener right now, I'd be so jazzed by what you said and thinking, what routines can I use to teach this in my classroom? I know you have some tools in your toolbox to share about instructional routines we can use in our classrooms to help students, you know, engage in spelling routines.
Yeah, I shared some of those at the presentation at Plain Talk, but there, I think they're probably likely familiar to a lot of your listeners, but phoning, graphing, mapping, Catherine Grace's work. Certainly for me, phoning, graphing, mapping is the bridge between phonology and orthography, right? That's exactly what it is. It's making clear the sequence of phonemes and then mapping those to the graphemes that represent them. In phoneme graphing mapping, we're kind of putting them into boxes, right? Or, you know, teachers can do that with a line for representing each sound that they hear and then representing the graphemes that represent those phonemes. But I think it's important to remember that prior to that, there was explicit instruction in those phonemes and graphemes because we can't map what we have not been taught. So especially for like high frequency words, which I know you've had others on talking about, certainly we want to map to all the sounds. There's no special place in the brain for a word like said and a word like cat. We orthographically map a word exactly the same. We look at the sequence of letters, the orthography, we map it to the phonemes. Maybe some of those graphemes are unexpected, but it doesn't matter. They map the same way. And if anything, Dave Kilpatrick on his book, Assessing, Preventing, and Overcoming Reading Difficulties, I don't know why this always sticks in my head, but on page 109 says, you know, those words need more attention, more analysis, not less. And we've been teaching the spelling of those in ways that focus on their visual form or their visual sequence rather than their linguistic features. So a simultaneous oral spelling, if you're Orton Gillingham trained, you're probably very familiar with that. You know, I say the word, you say, just like we were doing earlier, I say the word, you say the word. I want the phonological word form in your mouth correctly. So you have a memory for that. And then we tap out sounds. Right. I have you maybe write those lines or those boxes. How many sounds? Show me first sounds, for example, said, and then you just go in sequence. And I'm always using it in a sentence too. In order to bond a word in memory, you must bond phonology, orthography, and meaning. And my only concern with spelling in some routines that I'm seeing is there is no meaning. And we are assume-a-siding, as my friend Anita would say, we're assume-a-siding that the student has that meaning in their word, in their semantic lexicon, and they may not. So they're not going to form that fully specified memory for that word. They're not going to orthographically map it. So I think it's always important to think about how we're integrating, like back to the simple view. We're never living only in the land of word recognition or only in the land of meaning. We're always integrating language and not isolating that. And so within a sequence of a lesson, you would find this kind of routine, but it's not isolated. There's been a phonological probably warm-up prior to that. There's been a reminder of letter sound correspondences if it was kindergarten. There's a reminder of the sequence. We write from left to right. All of these language, if we're saying it in a sentence, we might say that's an adjective. Remember, that describes, an adjective describes. We're talking about its part of speech, its meaning, right? So I'm always thinking about the integration of phonology, orthography, morphology, semantics, syntax, even pragmatics. Where might you use that word, right? So I think it's really important to think of ourselves as teachers of language because language and literacy are interdependent. So when we're teaching spelling, maybe it's we're teaching reading, but we're really teaching language. But it's benefiting otherwise, right?
Can I just say, I just listened to Emily Hanford's new Soul to Story episode. She talked about that, like going overboard, right? We found a problem with, we weren't teaching phonics and phonemic awareness. And, you know, now we're seeing some people, not everybody, but some people going overboard. And like you said, not talking about the meaning of those words. And so I'm really glad you brought that up of, you know, we have to find that, bring it all together, not go overboard to the other side.
We do. It's an integrated language system. We really do. But again, teachers deserve the knowledge so that they can, right? And then I shared instructional routines. I think it's really important for teachers to have instructional routines that embed clear, concise language, explicit structures that embed that language. And the kids get used to that routine, right? And so what we were doing with routines as teachers is we're setting them up for success when they're independent, right? We want them thinking, okay, I should say the word. I'll say the word so I can hear it. It's in my mouth, right? The phonetic word. Now I have to think about the sounds. So I think instructional routines are critically important for teachers to marry the knowledge that they have. I always say the simple view of better outcomes for kids for me is, this is my simple view, is knowledge times practice. Because me having deep knowledge is critically important, but if I cannot translate that into practice, it doesn't matter for my students. So, and practice minus of knowledge, as soon as those kids do something that you don't expect, you don't know what to do. So you cannot be diagnostic and prescriptive. So we must have deep knowledge and aligned practices.
Oh, I love that. We talk a lot about practice on our podcast.
Yay. I'm a little obsessed with practice too.
I have a quick question before we move on about the simultaneous oral spelling routine. What happens with multisyllabic words? So I heard you talk about, you know, words and you're saying the sounds, but with multisyllabic words, do we say the syllables?
Yes, we would say the syllables, and then it's like you're chunking it up, right? You're breaking down a complex text. I think that, I'm not telling you anything you don't know or anyone else doesn't know, multisyllabic words can really scare kids. They see that big word and then they're like, oh my gosh, I can't do that. But really, we should be teaching multisyllabic words right from the beginning. If my students in kindergarten know CVC patterns for short vowels, that I'm doing napkin. I'm building those words right from the beginning, but I'm teaching them how they can, okay, let's take the first syllable nap, and then we're going to do the same thing. Say that. Say, I say it, you say it. Let's tap out the sounds, you know, write the lines. So you're chunking it up until they start consolidating those patterns, right? With enough practice with the words, they become as if by sight. And with enough practice with reading words and spelling words, we start teaching ourselves, we start seeing patterns, and we no longer have to go just to the phoneme level. We start consolidating that when we get into Aries consolidated phase. But until we get there, we need to support that. But it's pretty much the same process, but your syllable. And then I would be blending. Nap, let's blend. What syllable? Nap. Okay. And then we would do the kin, blend, napkin, word, napkin. Right. So that I want them consolidating it and also hearing it in a fluent voice. Right. And then in a sentence.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that quick little interlude into multisyllabic.
I almost had to grab my whiteboard. I almost grabbed a whiteboard here. It was very hard not to.
I know. It is. Especially with multisyllabic words.
Yes, yes. Or, you know, there's also like the spot and dot routines that we often see. We'll spot the vowels, and do you understand what I'm saying? And also, of course, we need to be teach kids to be flexible with those vowels. You know, that set for variability is really important. However, what I really want to point out about that is that for you to engage in set for variability, you also have to have that word in your semantic lexicon. If you don't know that I should pronounce AVID, avid, instead of avid, when I flex it, I could say avid or avid, and you would say to the students, well, which one sounds? And they would, I don't know. So again, the importance of, word recognition language systems and those the upper ends of the rope always being integrated, and how important in our own classrooms, our oral languages as a teacher, the way we are speaking, the way we expect our students to speak in complete sentences. We can't forget about all of that while we're ensuring that they can, map that code.
For sure. Okay. So we know that like the way that we used to kind of do things wasn't as effective, and you did give us some really valuable instructional routines. But one of the things that you did at the Plain Talk Conference that I really do want to talk about is looking at spelling. So, we're giving a spelling test. We're doing these routines. We're giving a spelling test. It gave valuable information. And I have to say, you really helped me like kind of rethink spelling tests. So I was curious if you could share, what can we learn from students errors or miscues on, quote, a spelling test or just, you know, a writing sample where they're writing and then having miscues and errors?
I think we can learn everything, actually, to be honest with you. I know that sounds a little bold, but spelling and writing is language written down. That's Louisa Moats, who's been studying spelling for decades now. You know, we have our spelling heroes like Dr. Moats and Dr. Treeman and Dr. Carricker. We've been fortunate to have researchers focus on spelling for many decades, but it really is language written down. Students are showing you what they know about our language in their spelling. And especially when, you know, what I shared at the Plain Talk, and what I've been trying to convince pretty much everyone I know as a teacher to do is to do a spelling inventory. And to do those when you do your universal screeners, like 3 times a year, you should also be doing a spelling inventory because it follows a scope and sequence. Again, that systematic least complex to most complex, you know, short vowel patterns all the way up to derivational spellings and all that. Depending on the grade level, of course. I mean, in kindergarten, I would start out with, you know, I would say, spell, right? It's a building block. But, you know, as they move up in the grades, the spelling inventory is a very critical tool to include in your assessment battery. When you're, you know, conducting the spelling inventory in your classroom, it's very simple. You just have to make sure the kids aren't looking, you know, little folders or something so they can't look on each other. And I say the word, you say the word, I give it to them in a sentence. And then basically I just be quiet and have them spell it. They have to be careful when we're pronouncing words that just as there was schwa day on Sunday, we don't overpronounce. So I would say bat. No. Don't want to do that. We want to be clear and accurate with how we're pronouncing the words. But pretty much I say, you say, I tell it to you in a sentence, you spell it. It takes maybe 10 minutes to do. It's really a brief whole class assessment. That's the beauty of it. However, I will say that the analysis of it takes longer, but it really is time well spent. And especially if you're doing it at grade level or with your peers, you start looking at patterns. And it's telling you, the thing about a spelling inventory is it can tell you about your curriculum. If you start seeing, and in some schools, this has actually happened that I've helped support the analysis of that. You start seeing a pattern in every single classroom. Every single classroom where there's a hole where when you look at the phonics scope and sequence, this pattern has been taught, everyone's missing it. Everyone, or many, many, many. So that's telling me maybe two things. The curriculum is not explicit enough. The curriculum does not allow enough practice, or we didn't allow enough practice for this pattern. But there's a hole here that has to be addressed. And that's so valuable. It's for me, and analyzing a spelling inventory with teachers, it's really rich, robust professional learning. We are talking about patterns that we see. We're talking about phonology, orthography, morphology. And one school that I work with, the kids were doing a great job. Now, this is second grade. Great job spelling phonetically. They represented all the speech sounds. They represented them in the correct sequence, but they were not orthographically correct in many cases for spelling patterns that they'd been taught. So that told me that maybe there was an overemphasis on phonology and not enough on the relationship. I mean, we all know that phonemic awareness, absolutely essential, but a means to an end. We're doing this so that we can map those phonemes to graphemes because that's how they read and will spell. So when you see it in every classroom, so they had a phonics curriculum. So you're like, well, I don't think they're teaching it as robustly as they could. How can we support them? Right? Because it's never the teacher's fault. Oftentimes it's that as leaders in schools, we must be, if we have big changes and high accountability, we need high support. They are also reciprocal. So we're looking at those through the lenses of phonology, orthography, and morphology, right? And we're looking for error patterns. And we're looking for students with similar error patterns so that we can be efficient and effective with our time, so that we can target small group instruction or whole group instruction. When we see it happening more than 60% across these spelling inventories, it's telling us that let's not waste our time on small group. Let's be efficient. And this is something that has to be taught whole group and practice and then assess to see if it's been mastered, right? Because we all know we have Swiss cheese kids with these holes. And I'm telling you, they show up in spelling. They're smack dab in your face. Reading happens in the moment. You see reading behaviors and they're elusive because they are done in the moment. And you have to be, as a teacher, kind of keeping track, right, of how they're reading, unless you're recording them, which was very helpful. But spelling is permanent. It's language written down. I can go back to it. I can look at a student's spelling in the beginning of the year, the middle of the year, the end of the year. Very powerful for a student to see, oh, I'm getting better. I can now spell this correctly, and they feel proud of themselves, and it's visually right there. So it's just such a spelling inventories are a powerful instructional tool that I believe, from all the work that I do in schools, is underutilized and could greatly benefit. However, again, I do think that absence of knowledge, you need the knowledge to know what you're looking at. And years ago, and I'll just speak for myself, I didn't have that. I feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to learn what I have learned, but also feel like, just like my Twitter handle, live to learn, as teachers, you know, we're always learning for the rest of our lives, right?
Pam, I'm wondering, do you ever look at spelling for different stages? Like, I'm thinking of like Aries stages, or I think Richard Gentry talked to us about similar stages he has in Brain Words. Do you look for that, or do you just look for those very specific skills?
I do that too. Oh. Yes. Yeah. So, yes, I'm aware of Gentry's stages and Aries phases, stages and phases. Yes, I definitely do that as well, because you would expect in the early grades, our kids would be semi-phonetic initially, right? They are aware of the speech sounds and they're represented with graphemes, and maybe just like what we were seeing in the second grade. See, we would expect that they had moved towards a phonetic stage where they were representing all the sounds with graphemes that are orthographically correct. You know, ortho meaning straight, and, you know, graph meaning the spelling, like, you know, correct spelling. So yes, definitely looking at them as well. And also Penapel and Suzanne Carriker in that amazing Bible, you know, multi-sensory teaching our basic language skills. They also have ways that we can look at spelling. So this is what I mean. So you and I, in just these few minutes, have talked about how we can look at them through phonology, orthography, morphology lenses. We've talked about how we can look at them through stages and phases, Gentry and Airy. And we've talked about how we can look at them on a continuum of scoring from getting closer to the correct spelling for that word to inform our instruction. So I think that's four ways that a spelling inventory and 10 minutes of your instructional time can lead to some really rich, effective, targeted instruction. That's the important thing there too. Like, we're being really efficient with our instruction, and because it's spelling, we can visibly see what we need to do next.
Yeah. And just to kind of reiterate, Pam, the thing that's standing out to me is that if it's the majority of kids, go ahead and reteach it whole group. And then if it's not, and it's small sections of students, you know, grab them small group to reteach that very targeted skill. I love the idea of using the spelling test as a teaching tool. I don't think as a student I ever received that. I don't think as a teacher I ever did that, with the primary grades at least. So I think that's so powerful to help the students see their errors instead of just see a test back and see like the red marks or whatever it might be. Like, you're teaching through error correction.
And you're teaching them about language, right? Their own language, how exciting and powerful, right?
Yeah. My quick question about the spelling inventories before we wrap up, just, I'm wondering, is a spelling inventory something a teacher would create themselves, or are there spelling inventories out there that that teachers can go to?
So yes, there are some out there. And when you look at really good programs, they are embedding spelling as a mastery assessment, right? And why? There's a reason UFLY uses spelling for mastery. It's because it demonstrated the student's ability, and you have it visibly right there. When you're teaching spelling, you are teaching reading, or you're benefiting it. So you know, what happens often in a phonics lesson, you know, we have a review of what we've learned before. We have a warm up in phonological awareness. We teach a new concept, right? And then we read it in connected text. Hopefully there's a connection between what has been taught. And then we do the dictation. And as teachers, we run out of time often. And so what concerns me is oftentimes it's the practice of the skills that have been taught that we run out of time for. The reading of connected text with that pattern so we can consolidate that word in memory and orthographically map it or that pattern. And then with spelling, it does take time, as it should. And kids are, you know, especially when they're younger, they have all those graphomotor things that they consider too. But what I always say to teachers is you don't skip those parts. Don't skip the practice of that. When they are reading connected text, you're listening for accuracy and automaticity of the skill that's been taught. And when you're encoding, you are looking for, you know, the ability to represent that fully specified in print. So I don't even know where, but, you know, I don't know where that went, but there I am on my soapbox again. What you decode, you should encode. What you encode, you should be decoding. You know, read again, they are reciprocal relationships, but you're going to get more bang for your buck. I'm not saying skip the decoding, but what I'm saying is please don't skip the encoding.
Yeah, that's very powerful. All right, Pam, what is one thing you'd love to leave our listeners with in regards to teaching spelling?
To borrow from Nike, just do it. Do it directly, do it systematically, do it formatively in terms of assessment, use it to inform your instruction, your intervention. Talk about the visible language that you see with your peers. Do it together. You'll learn so much about language and how to target that instruction. But it's really important to do it. But to have those caveats of do it aligned with the research and the evidence for what's going to be most effective for your students. Because every teacher I know and you know, that's what they want for their kids, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. I know we've mentioned a lot of resources throughout this whole podcast, but do you have any other suggestions for where people can learn more about spelling instruction?
I have many suggestions. I have lots of books. Top few. Speech to Print, of course, without a doubt. Louisa Moats. Lynn Stone, Spelling for Life. This is probably one, a newer one that maybe some folks aren't familiar with, from Sue Hegland, Beneath the Surface of Words. Oh, there you go. That's a great one. I have a Wakelet where I have like all kinds of spelling. You know, I'm a little crazy about that kind of stuff, but How Spelling Supports Reading is something Louisa Moats wrote many years ago. There's another one, How Spelling Casts a Spell by Joshi Treeman, Moats and Carricker. The multisensory basic skills, an excellent chapter in there from Carricker. The Louise Spear Swirling book recently that came out that had about structured literacy and spelling. Louisa did that chapter on spelling. So there's a lot out there, honestly, that's really good for spelling. And those are just some that come off the top of my head. And I have lots of other ones over here. The other thing I want to say is for anyone who has a knowledge around the phonemes of our language, back to my Taylor Swift song, I never, ever, ever look at spelling without a a consonant and vowel chart right next to me. I never, ever, ever do that. And when I'm thinking about orthography, I always have the phonics scope and sequence for what has been taught, because I don't expect them to spell a pattern that has not yet been taught, right? And hopefully we are teaching morphology. And so I'm looking at the morphemes that have been taught. And so therefore I'm expecting, so I'm never expecting students to spell what has not been taught, which means we actually need to be teaching it directly and explicitly.
Yeah. Pam, I'm hopeful that maybe you could take a picture of your book stack for us and send it to us one day. Like at some point in the future, we'll blast it on social, because I think everyone would be interested. Like Pam Kastner's spelling resources recommendations.
I love that. A little obsessed there. Sorry.
No, it's so great. I was writing it down and I think I lost track at some point, but I'll listen again. Well, thank you so much. This was such a joy, and keep on spelling.
To stay connected with us, sign up for our email list at literacypodcast.com, join our Facebook group, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter.
If this episode resonated with you, take a moment to share with a teacher friend or leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
Just a quick reminder that the views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests of the Melissa and Lori Love Literacy podcast are not necessarily the opinions of Great Minds PBC or its employees.
We appreciate you so much, and we're so glad you're here to learn with us.